Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Muslims in America. From politics to the workplace, are Muslims here carving out their own identity? This is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. The Muslim religious tradition of Hajj has begun, drawing Muslims from around the world to religious sites in Saudi Arabia. Here in the United States, the nation's first Muslim congressman will be sworn into office next week. What does it mean to be Muslim in America? How does the religion fit with American cultural and political life? Does the practice of Islam here differ from the practice of Islam in other parts of the world? First, here's the news. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Next week, America's first Muslim congressman will be sworn into office, while this week, Muslims from around the world have begun the traditional religious pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. What does it mean to be Muslim in America? Does American culture affect the way Muslims practice their religion? Does the Muslim religion affect the way Muslims practice politics? My first guest is Summer Hatoot, a board member of the Muslim Public Affairs Council and co-founder of the Muslim Women's League. She works as a criminal prosecutor in Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You have made the Hajj, the journey to Mecca. Can you start by telling us what that's like?
The Hajj, or the pilgrimage, is a time for Muslims to connect with each other. It's a fairly amazing experience to be in a place where there are over 1 million other Muslims doing the exact same thing you're doing, looking exactly the way you look in terms of what you're wearing, what you're carrying with you. We are all complete equals performing various rituals throughout the time period.
How many women make the Hajj? Is it an unusual thing for women to be able to do it?
No, it's not unusual at all. Probably half the people who went were women. I mean, it's everyone is there. Everyone goes. They're children, you know, not small children, but teenagers, senior citizens, adults.
Traditionally, it's something in Islam that's done when one's obligations in life are fulfilled, isn't it? I think sometimes people associate it with an older population.
People do generally because you obviously need to be able to afford to do it, and you want to be in a place in your life where you think you will be spiritually fulfilled from it. So you don't necessarily want to do it when you're extremely young, but you also don't want to be too old because it is somewhat physically rigorous. There is a lot of walking involved.
What did you feel you had accomplished by doing the Hajj?
I felt a tremendous sense of community being with that many people, all of whom share my faith, but who I really had no direct contact with, just all of us sharing the same experiences, and just being in a place where the sole purpose was to commune with God.
And it's a requirement, if one is capable of affording it, to make the Hajj during the lifetime of a Muslim, is it not?
Yes, that's correct. It is one of our pillars of faith that every Muslim who is able to do so should do so at least once in their lifetime.
And perhaps we could talk for a moment also about those five pillars of faith, which I'm sure will help shape the conversation today.
Sure. Well, our pillars are prayer, which we do five times a day, fasting during the month of Ramadan, the pilgrimage, and almsgiving to the poor, and the declaration that there is no God but the one God and that Muhammad is his messenger.
Okay, thanks for explaining the Hajj to us. We're going to explore several issues with you in the course of the show. At the moment, I'd like to bring in another guest, Paul Barrett, who's the author of the new book, American Islam, The Struggle for the Soul of a Religion. He's assistant managing editor of Business Week magazine. He was a reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal when he began researching his book. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We've heard sort of a lively description of what an individual's obligation and response is in making Hajj, which Muslims all over the world do. You explored specifically Muslims in America. Give us a general overview of what surprised you the most of what you found.
Well, can start with just some of the very basic demographic information, much of which I think would be news to most Americans. Muslims, on average, in the U.S. are better educated and more prosperous than their non-Muslim neighbors. They're very politically active. 4 out of 5 who are eligible are registered to vote, very heavily invested in stocks and mutual funds and all kinds of other emblems of being well assimilated in this country.
And are those immigrant Muslims or are they indigenous Muslims?
Well, that's a good question, and the generalizations I was just making would apply to the combination of immigrant Muslims and primarily African-American converts to the religion. The breakdown along those lines is actually probably a little different from what most non-Muslim listeners would assume. The largest subgroup is not made up of Arab Americans. It's made up of people who have roots in South Asia. Most estimate that about 34% of the American Muslim population came from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan. Arab Americans make up about 26%. American blacks make up about 20%. And the final 20% is made up of a combination of people from Africa, countries like Iran, and others.
I'm curious, you came to the subject as an outsider. What impelled you to work on this book and to want to learn more?
My curiosity has a very personal roots. I mean, I used to work with the Wall Street Journal, as you pointed out. The Wall Street Journal's offices are across the street from the World Trade Center. And I was, you know, basically on the street a couple blocks away from the World Trade Center on that terrible day, was not injured. But the attacks directly affected this institution that I was very close to. We were basically bombed out of our offices, which were very heavily damaged. And it was a year before we got back to sort of our normal routine back in our offices. At that point, even though my main job at the time was working as an editor, I had just become more and more curious about Muslim life in this country as it had received more attention. And so I began doing some articles for the journal on that subject, and those articles then eventually grew into a proposal for a book.
I'm curious, on a personal level, how did 9/11 affect your attitude? You said you were curious, but did you come in with any preconceptions or prejudices in writing the book?
Well, you know, it's always a little hard to talk about one's own prejudices because one aspect of prejudice is you may not be fully aware of it. I mean, I guess to put my cards on the table, I'm kind of a middle of the road, dyed-in-the-wool journalist in terms of my own politics. I mean, political activism not played any role in my adult life. I'm Jewish, so people are often curious as to what my background is, and of course, that has to affect one's outlook. But one of the main questions I had, and which I looked into in many contexts, was attitudes among American Muslims toward Al-Qaeda, toward terrorism, toward the issues that underlie terrorism. In other words, not just the organizations themselves, but the complaints that those organizations have, which vary, and some are related very directly to the State of Israel, others are directed toward hostility to the West being present in the Middle East at all. A lot of it has to do with relationships with governments in the Middle East. So I was very curious as to how American Muslims viewed those things.
We'll come back to that in the show, but briefly for the moment, were you surprised by what you learned?
I was surprised in many cases and not so surprised in others. I was surprised, just to pick one example out of the hat, at the degree of flux and debate and controversy there is within American Islam over, for example, the role of women in the religion in this country and around the world. I hadn't realized that there was that kind of conflict over it. I, on the other hand, was not at all surprised to find that there is deep and abiding hostility toward Israel, and to the degree that there is anger directed toward the American government by otherwise very, very patriotic American Muslims, it is often traceable to the American link to Israel historically and to what many American Muslims see as the kind of unthinking American backing of Israel, reflexive backing of Israel in the terrible strife surrounding Israel, the Palestinians, and other Arab neighbors of that country.
Okay, thanks so much. That's Paul Barrett, author of the new book, American Islam, The Struggle for the Soul of a Religion. Let's bring another guest into the conversation. Muqtadar Khan is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. He's also assistant professor of political science at the University of Delaware. His books include American Muslims, Bridging Faith and Freedom, and his most recent book, Islamic Democratic Discourse. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm curious how we've just sort of heard a spread of ideas here from Samer Hatoot and Paul Barrett about Islam in America. What specifically about politics among Muslims in America? We do have coming into office next week the first Muslim congressman.
Well, one thing that is interesting about American Muslims is that they do not fit very well into the American political spectrum. For example, American Muslims tend to be politically liberal and socially conservative. So for some American Muslims, if gay marriages becomes a very important issue, they would vote for Republicans. But on most other issues, such as support for affirmative action, etc., they're very democratic. They would also support a welfare state to a great extent. Alternatively, American Muslims also have this interesting tension within them. They are extremely grateful to the freedoms of religion that they find in America. However, they are also very critical of American foreign policy. Sometimes I use the metaphor of a centaur to describe how Muslims perceive America. Centaur is essentially a Greek mythological figure which is half human and half beast. For American Muslims, the human face of America is turned inwards, democracy and tolerance, whereas the beastly face of America, of imperialism, invasion, military exercises, is turned outwards towards the Muslim world. So there are these tensions, the political tensions that American Muslims are trying to reconcile with. As far as Keith Ellison is concerned, I think it once again reminds American Muslims that while the indigenous element of the American Muslim community remains economically marginalized, they are politically mainstreamed, whereas the immigrant community is economically mainstreamed but politically still on the margins.
Referring back to the comment you made about the conflict that some Muslims have, or many Muslims have, in regards to the appreciation they have for the freedoms they have in America, but the criticism they have of foreign policy, how does that play into their ability to speak out against terrorist acts, yet at the same time it seems sometimes balance support for groups that are other people consider terrorist groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah?
Well, the issue for American Muslims is that sometimes they find American foreign policy is extremely unjust. For example, they take the case of Hamas in Palestine. Muslims believe that Hamas has a legitimate reason to resist occupation of Israel, but Hamas has been termed a terrorist organization in the U.S., and that creates huge problems for them to legitimately support Palestinian opposition to Israeli occupation, because in trying to support Palestinians, they end up supporting Hamas, and then they look as if they are supporting terrorism, and they believe that the laws which deem Hezbollah and Hamas as terrorist organizations are unfair and unjust and are a reflection of the enormous influence that the Israeli lobby has in politics in America. So in that sense, American Muslims are caught in a very terrible bind. They empathize very strongly with the sufferings of the Palestinians, but they cannot fully support the cause of the Palestinians, because in many ways, supporting the Palestinians has become an illegitimate and an illegal activity in the United States. So this creates a strong sense of frustration while America talks about freedom and democracy, and when Palestinians do elect Hamas, we boycott that government. And so we see, Muslims see this as a double standard that America applies every time Israel is involved in issues that concern Muslims. So American foreign policy plays a major role on how American Muslims complete this journey of Americanization, especially the immigrant Muslims, in their own lives.
We've been talking to Muqtadar Khan, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. I'd like to bring in Mahdi Bray, Executive Director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation, which aims to expand Muslim civic involvement. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We were talking about many things, but in particular, the difference between the experiences of immigrant Muslims who've come to the United States from other countries and so-called indigenous Muslims. For example, many African Americans who've converted to Islam. You're in the latter group.
That's correct.
And tell us about your conversion and how it affects your life within the American sort of political and cultural mainstream.
Well, certainly I converted 28 years ago. I grew up in the South. I'm 56 years old, so I'm no stranger to the whole concept of apartheid or segregation. And one of the things that I found so fascinating, you're talking about the Hajj, and my first experience with the Hajj in going some 4 years ago was this whole egalitarian process that takes place in Islam. And for me, that was quite an attractive aspect for me in terms of my conversion. And also, I think also for me, also being a product of the 60s, just the personal need to have a spiritual center or spiritual compass in my life, and I found that Islam provided that for me. So that's the way I came into Islam. But I certainly, it would be disingenuous not to say that one of the things that really, really attracted me was the realization that as a young boy growing up in the South, that one of the most segregated places in America was actually the church on Sunday for Christians. And then to be able to deal with a faith tradition that says that there isn't a black mosque or a white mosque or Asian mosque. There's a mosque, and you go to that particular mosque, and even though maybe that particular mosque might be dominated by maybe a certain ethnic group, there was certainly no restrictions to say that you can't come in here and pray because you're not of this ethnic group or that ethnic group. And so that was one of the things I found very fascinating about Islam. I think the other thing, too, is that I remember, I come from three generations of Christian theologians, and I remember in my great-grandfather's church, who was what we used to call High Baptist, a kind of a middle-class Baptist, black Baptist church, that well-off people could actually purchase pews and you sit on the pews that were purchased. In Islam, I don't care if you don't have a penny, if you come to the mosque early to pray, then you are in the front, and if you're the most wealthiest person in town, if the mosque is filled, then you sit in the back. So those kind of things certainly for me were not lost. But again, I think the other salient factor for my conversion to Islam was simply the need to be spiritually grounded and find that Islam was the religion that provided that kind of moral and spiritual compass for me.
You've explained how the egalitarian nature of Islam has appealed to you quite eloquently. I'm curious, some news reports, some people comment at times on the frictions, if you will, that might be too strong a word, between immigrant Muslims and the indigenous Muslim population of the United States. How does that play out?
Well, I think certainly it's there, but I think it has really improved. I think 9/11 has been a great healer. I often tell people now, in a post-9/11 environment, one of the things you find that many of people within the immigrant community that perhaps thought they were exempt from some of the type of discrimination patterns that maybe African Americans and other minority groups in America have experienced realized after 9/11 that they were there. So that was kind of a binding factor. But I think the other thing that really increases the cohesiveness between the two groups and the, quote, indigenous and the immigrant is the fact of our children. We're now almost into a fourth generation. I'm a convert. My children were born and raised Muslim. Many immigrants, their children were born and raised Muslim. So they are American Muslims. They've only known America as their home, and they've only known Islam as their faith tradition. So that begins to remove those barriers that come between converts or indigenous and immigrants, and that's a good thing. One of the exciting things that you're beginning to see in America is what I call the authentic American identity.
The authentic American identity in what way?
Well, very similar to the way that you look at, and I make an analogy here, the Catholics, the American Catholic movement. Certainly, when Catholics first came, they primarily came as Irish, Italian, and from Europe as immigrants, and there was a really strong tendency towards Catholicism within the way of Europe, within the way of the Vatican. Certainly, if you look today in terms of the social mores and how the American Catholics, they're still Catholics and they're still Orthodox and Orthodox within their Catholic expressing their faith. But nevertheless, they have a distinct identity that is certainly different from those Catholics who are in Europe. And likewise, I think that you will find that the American Muslim community is unique and distinct from even the Muslims in Europe or even Muslims who are in the Middle East or abroad. We have an authentic American tradition. A good example was Dr. Khan John was also Paul were talking about the relationship in terms of Israel, which boils down to also the relationship between Muslims and Jews. Well, certainly for me as an American Muslim born here in America, my pathology with the Jewish community might be quite different from someone else who comes from the Middle East who has only had a relationship with the Jewish community in terms of, you know, occupier versus, you know, being occupied, whereas as an African-American growing up in both the civil rights and the labor movement, you know, our relationship with the Jewish community was based on being allies. So all these factors play in developing what I call an authentic American-Muslim identity.
That's an interesting explanation, and I'm curious on that last point you raised up about having a different relationship with the Jewish community. You have at times, your group has at times been criticized for appearing to be supportive of Hamas and Hezbollah. How do you sort of bring those two points together that you were just talking about, having a different relationship possibly with the Jewish tradition, yet also being accused of siding too much with those organizations?
Well, I think one of the things that, first I think that maybe the criticism it might be unwarranted, but nevertheless, let me just say I've been critical of the policy of Israel, certainly, but being critical of the policy of Israel doesn't certainly lead towards not having a amicable relationship with people of the Jewish faith. So,
Thank you for making that point. I'm good. I'd like to bring a guest back into the show who's been waiting, Samer Hatoot. We talked with you at the top of the show about your pilgrimage, the Hajj that you made several years ago, board member of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and a co-founder of the Muslim Women's League. I'm interested in two things that we've been hearing in the conversation. First, to find out from you if you think there is, as we've just been hearing from Madi Bray, a distinctly American Muslim sort of personality or identity, and secondly, the role of Muslim women within that identity.
Okay. To address the first point, yes, there definitely is the formation of an American Muslim identity, and many of us have been working on that for a number of years because we don't see any conflict between our religion and our country, whether we are here indigenously or as immigrants. In fact, they work quite well hand in hand, the issues of social justice that are in Islam and American democracy. In terms of the role of Muslim women, the role of women in Islam is absolutely critical. And unfortunately, as Paul had mentioned, there is still flux and debate among some people about what the role of Muslim women is and how Islam views women.
I'm curious, for example, is it a requirement to wear hijab, the traditional headscarf covering, or do some women not feel comfortable wearing it in a culture that's so distinctly at odds with those traditions?
Well, you're going to get a different answer from everybody you ask. My opinion, and based on my research and everything that I have read, is it is not a requirement. Dressing modestly is a requirement, and that is a requirement for men and women.
And within the Islamic tradition here, you know, in some countries, of course, it's a very enforced custom. It's something that's insisted upon for women. Is the Islamic tradition within the United States supportive of your feelings that it should be the choice of women?
Yes, I believe that is the majority opinion, that it is a woman's choice. Of course, there is still debate. I mean, I'm not going to deny that. And there will be people who will tell you adamantly that it is a religious requirement. If you don't do it, you're not following your religion. But I think that is a minority opinion.
Okay. Let's go back to Muqtadar Khan to talk a little bit more about these issues of culture. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Are there any particular pitfalls for Muslims within traditional American culture that makes it more difficult?
Well, there are several pitfalls. American culture is very seductive, and as a result of that, there is a continuous attrition within the community. But what is interesting is that America offers more opportunities than threats to Muslims, and particularly at a time when there is so much of constraint in the Muslim world in particular, where Muslims do not have the opportunity to even think freely and try to negotiate what role Islam needs to play. There are several questions that Muslims need to answer. What is the role of Islam in modern life? What is the role of Islam in the public sphere? How will Muslims relate with non-Muslims? And we cannot even have these conversations and discussions in the Muslim world because there is no intimidation-free environment where Muslims could articulate alternate positions which are different from the orthodoxy and traditionally held values. the American public sphere offers American Muslims this enormous opportunity to nurture independent thinking, to nurture Muslim scholars who constantly are willing to push the envelope, ask the serious question, to question orthodoxy. And I think that is the greatest opportunity and gift of America to American Muslims, this freedom to think.
Okay, that's all the time we have today. Thanks very much to all of our guests, Summer Hatoot, Paul Barrett, Mahdi Bray, and Mokhtader Khan. The producers of Which Way LA are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Dan Konecki, and Vanessa Romo. The managing producer is Karen Radziner. The technical director is Phoebe Zimmerman. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. A reminder, you can access past shows at kcrw.com. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. He'll be back next week. Happy New Year. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.